From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, state Democrats and Republicans will convene this weekend with a Tea Party effort to force Brian Kelly out as lieutenant governor.
Tea Partiers and very conservative Republicans looking at the Snyder administration and saying, you know what, you may say you're conservative, but you are not conservative enough.
The story of Northland Center in Oakland County, the ups and downs of one of the very first shopping centers in America.
1954, when this mall was opened, was the peak of receipts in downtown Detroit. It's as if they built this mall and said, okay, we're moving to the suburbs.
And we talk with the Michigan country vet who's become an unlikely reality TV star, practicing veterinary medicine with a cameraman in tow.
I'm not putting that calf back in the cow to pull it out for a second take.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. If you're going to talk about the history of shopping malls in America, you have to talk about Detroit and cars.
The car builds Detroit. Detroit builds the mall, and the mall and the car lead to the problems of Detroit.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, how one of the first malls in America helped to change the face of Detroit. Then a new anti-scrapping law was supposed to make it harder for scrap metal thieves, but one Detroit lawmaker says, not so much. That story later this hour. But first, it's a big weekend for Michigan's Democrats and Republicans. Both parties hold their state conventions, the Dems in Lansing, the GOP in Novi. Here with a preview are the co-hosts of It's Just Politics, Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Hi, you two.
Hi, Cindy.
Hello.
Rick, I want to start with the Republicans. We hear so much nationally about tensions in the GOP between the mainstream Republicans and the Tea Party, and here it is, center stage, playing out in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that the Tea Party is making some noises about wanting to take out Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly. We should point out that even though Governor Snyder won his primary and he ran unopposed, as did his Democratic challenger, Mark Schauer, that most of the statewide offices are actually selected by party delegates at state conventions. And so Brian Kelly has to be selected, ratified by the party convention, as will Attorney General Bill Schuette, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, Supreme Court and Education Board candidates. And Wes Nakagiri, a Tea Partier, has presented himself as a challenger to Brian Kelly. But quite frankly, the Snyder team thinks that they've kind of have probably a 2-to-1 advantage among the 2,100 delegates that will be headed to Novi on Saturday, and so they're pretty confident that Kelly can survive the challenge, and they just want to make sure that it's a respectable victory, not one that is too loud and raucous and messy, and also not too terribly close. They wouldn't want to suffer that embarrassment either.
Right. But what we're seeing here, Cindy, like you mentioned, is this sort of establishment GOP versus the Tea Party fight playing out. And it will, as Rick says, play out over the weekend. And one of the issues here is Tea Partiers and very conservative Republicans looking at the Snyder administration and saying, you know what? You may say you're conservative, but you are not conservative enough. And they've been bringing
up issues.
Right. You
may be the administration that made Michigan a right-to-work state,
right,
but that's still not conservative enough.
Enough for
us.
And they're bringing up things like the Common Core educational standards, like the governor's vocal support for the Medicaid expansion. And so they're saying, hey, you know, we want to take at least one of yours down if we have the ability. But meanwhile, we've seen this interesting dynamic of Kelly coming out and saying things like, I'm the conservative voice in the Snyder administration. You know, I am the real Republican voice who everyone looks to me. So there's this dynamic indeed, like you say, playing out.
Well, let me ask you, does anyone expect that, all right, should this happen and should the Tea Party succeed and dump Kelly and get Wes Nakagiri on the ticket, that Nakagiri is going to have any kind of important role in a Rick Snyder administration? Do they think
right.
Rick Snyder is going to go, well, sure, come on in, no problem.
Right. And then
in,
I think
in the highly theoretical universe that you have just placed us in, Cindy, Wes Nakagiri would not be a player
right.
in that administration.
It's a little bit of a fantasy world that bet that somehow what the Tea Party is saying, if Nakagiri was in that office, that he would somehow be able to pull some levers. And I just think that that is just so not the case.
Wes
so,
Nakagiri would find that there are not a lot of things that would be taking up his time to distract him from his main responsibility
missions.
Of presiding over the state Senate.
Right. He would have long treks to go overseas. I want to say one thing, too. I mean, what's interesting, I think a lot of this is about the headlines, right? That what they're at least getting out of this is having us have the discussion about the influence that Tea Party wants to have or is trying to show that they have. So whether or not this comes to blow on Saturdays, we are talking about what kind of influence the Tea Party has. They are not going away, and they're making sure that's the case by making these kind of headlines.
But it strikes me that there's a balance to be struck between the Tea Party getting its voice and the real political price to be paid if this thing happens.
Absolutely.
And if suddenly Brian Kelly's left in the dirt, there's got to be a terrific fear of a political price, Zoe.
Yeah, absolutely.
But just remember that we're spending a lot of time on this, and it's not going to happen. I said, they've done some nose counting, and they think that they've probably got a 2-to-1 advantage for Brian Kelly among the regular delegates. Mm-hmm. If some of those delegates don't show up, which, you know, turnout can be an issue at conventions, and alternates are seated, Wes Nakagiri might do a little bit better. But really, the question is really what Brian Kelly's margin of victory is going to be. And Team Snyder is trying to make sure that that is a commanding, respectable margin and not a close, embarrassing one.
But like Rick mentioned earlier, and Rick and I also like to say that these Republican conventions tend to be a little bit like the wild, wild west. That, yes, I think we probably know what the outcome will be, but we've seen at other conventions there are fireworks. I mean, we have this great audio bite, right, Rick, of this gentleman.
It was actually
going,
from 4 years ago, right? And it was a Tea Party delegate who was fighting to get their nominee for lieutenant governor. And he said that politics is a blood sport. People fight,
we
scratch.
We scream, we bite, you know. And so these are folks who just are so passionate about it. They are not going to let this convention not make headlines and be quiet, whether or not we all know what the outcome is going to be.
You know, it kind of takes a special sort of political animal to be a state party delegate, especially if you're traveling from, you know, one of the further away points.
The UP,
in
for
the state.
Example. Sure, sure.
Yeah,
you know, driving 11 hours
down from the UP at your own expense, then you're pretty passionate. And one of the things that the Michigan Republican establishment ran into was that, they wanted their Republican Party to, act in service to them, but they weren't particularly interested in the mechanical aspects of it, showing up at conventions as delegates, you know, running for precinct delegate, getting nominated to be a delegate to the state convention, and, and then showing up to vote, which is why Brian Kelly had to put a huge effort into creating a recruitment apparatus to get Cali supporters to run for precinct delegate, to show up at the county conventions, to be delegates to the state convention so that they could show up and vote for him.
You both are real clear that the Tea Party has really built up a head of steam over this, and they want the headlines and they want that attention. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't happen, and then what? Because where's that head of steam going to go? What do you think would be next for the Tea Party?
It's a good question, Cindy. And one of the things that I think I'll be watching for, at least, is this new freshman kind of group of lawmakers, Republican Tea Partiers who won their primaries in August. They won in Republican districts, so likely will win again in November. You're looking at Lee Chatfield, Todd Corser, Gary Glenn, these group of Tea Party Republicans who will be coming into the state house come January and ready to mix things up. And I was talking to Todd Corser, who won his seat last week, who said, you know, politics is a blood sport. We are ready to go. We are not going to compromise. We are going to push what we want to see. And so that's what I'm going to be looking for.
Let's switch gears and talk about the Democrats, where we know it's a done deal that Mark Schauer and Lisa Brown are going to head the ticket. So not quite as much drama to be expected at their convention in Lansing.
We are not going to see nearly as many fireworks coming out of Lansing as we will Novi. That's for sure.
It, it's interesting that the Republican Party convention rules are pretty straightforward. The Democratic Party rules, actually, there is only one person at any given time who actually understands the rules for a Michigan Democratic Party state convention. But as soon as that person knows them, he instantly goes mad and they need to find someone else. So, you know, anything could happen. But we are expecting that, you know, that there won't be any big fights among the delegates over the tickets. There won't be a fight over over Lisa Brown, that she's pretty popular with the base. Mm-hmm. We will see a fight potentially over one of the lower ballot positions, which is Michigan Supreme Court Justice. Every now and then, the Michigan Democrats try to toss a pro-life, that is anti-abortion nominee, into the mix to basically, you know, try to invite those voters and say, look, you can support us. They've got a appeals court judge, William Murphy, who's in line to be nominated for the state Supreme Court. But a lot of the party's progressive base doesn't want a pro-life candidate on the Democratic ballot.
It'll be also interesting to look at the two races, the Democratic nominees for Attorney General and Secretary of State, not getting a lot of attention. And so, you know, part of that is because they only recently even settled on who their Secretary of State nominee was going to be. So that'll be interesting, too, to see how much name recognition those candidates can get out of this weekend and see if they can't use some of that to kind of parlay, you know, this race against the current Attorney General Bill Schuette and the current Secretary of State Ruth Johnson.
In some respects, a non-controversial convention works against you if you're a political party leader, because you want to use that as an opportunity to get what's called some earned media.
Mm-hmm.
Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team. As always, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
nice
Cindy.
Nice talking to you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some organizations these days are having a pretty hard time getting new people involved. Classical music groups are struggling to appeal to new music fans, and plenty of arts and culture groups have a tough time roping in new members. It turns out historical societies are also having a tough time, and that's something that Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris has been looking into. Hey, Kyle.
Hey.
And Amy Elliott Bragg is here. She helped co-found a group with my favorite name, the Detroit Drunken Historical Society. She's also president of the board of directors at Preservation Detroit. Amy is someone who is managing to recruit new faces into her groups. Welcome back to Stateside, Amy.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Kyle, set the stage for us. Just what is the big problem that historical societies in Michigan are really wrestling with?
The big, big picture is that the folks who tend to be involved and run these things are older folks, tend to be retired and above in age, and they're kind of burning out or they're winding down. And getting new blood, recruiting youngins, it's not going so well in general. I'm speaking broadly here, but that's the issue.
But Amy Elliott Bragg, that is not the experience that you're having, because both the groups you're involved with have gotten really diverse audiences to take part. Now, I want to start with the Detroit Drunken Historical Society.
Sure.
Describe a typical event for us and the crowd that shows up.
Well, the Detroit Drunken Historical Society is a meetup group. That's how people find out about it. We have a page on meetup.com. We have a Facebook page. About once a month, we organize an activity, usually a lecture or a discussion of some kind, and we host it at a local bar in Detroit. We get people from all walks of life coming out to hang out with us and learn about history. People are not necessarily all young people. That's, I think, a common misconception about the Detroit Drunken Historical Society. It's a really diverse age group. It's just a big mix of people.
Why are you able to make that happen?
Well, I think that people are attracted to the Detroit Drunken Historical Society in the way that we position ourselves as a good time history group. The events are really informal. They're very low key, usually free. There's no need to become a member of the Detroit Drunken Historical Society. You almost never need to buy your tickets in advance. If you're just looking for something interesting to do, it's kind of first come, first serve. All are welcome.
And there's beer.
so that's a big secret of our success. And, you know, I think people genuinely are interested in history, especially in Detroit, where people want to become more engaged in Detroit. They're fascinated by Detroit. Detroit. History is a way for people to get into that. And we present the opportunity to learn about history in a very easy way.
Easy way. And you said, and like, not commitment. So you're not signing up. You're not paying dues.
You know, they often talk about, like, so they're the sort of hardcore history buffs who are on board and they're reading these books every night. They're signed up. They studied this in school. They love it. They eat it. They breathe it. Mm-hmm. But then there's, like, the rest of us who are like, this is kind of cool. I might go to, like, this thing where I can get a beer and hear a lecture, which I would do. I'm not a hardcore, but I would do that. And I think with this group, they have tapped that. They found this sort of formula to tap that broad group.
You know, I think preservation is an interesting kind of subset of historical activities in that it is about history and it is about scholarship, but it's also about sense of place and building community. And I think that people are becoming attracted to historic preservation as younger people because they are interested in living in an urban environment. They're interested in living in a place with a unique character. They're interested in walkability. They're interested in reuse and rehabilitation as an environmentally sustainable approach to building a city. There are just a lot of ways that people who are young and engaged in the urban environment can tap into historic preservation.
Well, you know, talking about this struggle to attract new members and to pass the baton, so to speak, it's not exclusive to historic groups. Many nonprofits and arts and cultural organizations are wrestling with this. So what is the one big piece of advice you would both give to any group that wants to attract new blood and new members? Amy, I'll start with you.
Sure. The thing that we have found to be the most successful, both at Preservation Detroit and through the Drunken Historical Society, is to take a really inclusive approach. We have found that, as Kyle mentioned, there are people who might not be immersed in their library of historical texts all night, but they like history, they're interested in it, they want to weigh in. We see the same thing with preservation. There are people who would never call themselves a preservationist, but they don't want buildings demolished that could still be repurposed. They might have just bought a property themselves and they're interested in rehabilitating their old home. And those people are doing preservation every day. We have been trying to find ways to reach out to them, to be inclusive to them, to help them find ways to get engaged with our organization and to provide value to them as an organization. So that has been working for us.
Kyle Norris, based on the work you've done for this story, what do you think?
I'm going to piggyback on that and say, like, you know, look at who you're inviting to the table and are you being really broad and thinking outside of the box? Because sometimes historic groups and other kinds of groups are just sort of doing the same old and not thinking of who they're appealing to and whose stories they're telling. So thinking broadly, inviting a little more folks to the table, thinking about that. And then kind of what these guys do, make it fun, make history something you can do, an activity, an event you can show up with, a tour you can walk around a city, like make it something fun that you want to do.
Well, Amy Elliott Bragg and Kyle Norris, thanks guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some 40 years ago, Jan Pohl emigrated from the Netherlands to Michigan. These days, he's a veterinarian with a country practice near Mount Pleasant, and he also happens to be a reality TV star. The incredible Dr. Pohl begins his fifth season this weekend on National Geographic Wild. Pohl also has a new autobiography, Never Turn Your Back on an Angus Cow, My Life as a Country Vet. Dr. Jan Pohl, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much, Cindy. How are you?
I'm great. Hey, doctor, when did you learn that lesson, never turn your back on an Angus cow? Did you learn that the hard way?
Basically, yes. And that was already done when I was in the Netherlands growing up on the dairy farm. You turn your back, you cannot outrun a cow, you cannot run out a horse, you cannot outrun most of the animals on the planet.
So you learn the very hard way. You don't turn your back on an animal.
Yes, you do.
An obvious question to start with, Dr. Pohl, has to be, how did a fellow who grew up on this dairy farm in the Netherlands make his way to a small town in mid-Michigan? And your book tells us that you came to Michigan for love.
Of course. Cherchez la femme. I was the youngest of six in the Netherlands, and my sister moved to Canada in the mid-50s. In order to farm, because the Netherlands is crowded and there's not enough farmland for everybody. As the youngest, I had no chance to become a farmer. And when I thought that my parents should go to Canada and visit my sister, I tried to become an exchange student, and that ended up being in Michigan. And when I went back to college in the Netherlands, they told us, you want to become a veterinarian? That is fine. Do you want to practice? Forget it. There's too many of you guys. So I thought, let me go become a veterinarian and I'll go to Australia, New Zealand. Those countries still appeal to me. I still would like to visit them sometime. But anyway, Diane and I met in high school and we kept on writing together. And she came over to the Netherlands, back and forth a couple times until we got married in 1967. And we went back to the Netherlands where I finished school and then just came right back to Michigan.
I love the fact that you actually were placed with Diane's family when you came over here for high school for your exchange year. You mm-hmm. never know what can happen out of an exchange year, do you?
I know. And, you know, this is not the thing that normally happen, but for some reason or another, you know, when Diane came over in 64, my father was dying with bone cancer. That's when, you know, all things started happening. And when you know that you can depend on somebody to take care of things, you get a lot closer together. And after that, it became really serious. And like I said, it was still 5 years after I came back before we got married. I'm very happy. We have 47 years together already.
That's a pretty good track record, Dr. Pohl. I'm talking with Dr. Jan Pohl, whose new book is Never Turn Your Back on an Angus Cow, My Life as a Country Vet. And he, of course, is the star of the National Geographic Wilds hit TV series, The Incredible Dr. Pohl, which is starting its fifth season this coming Sunday. I love your line in the book, Doctor. Here's the line. I just said, I love this. For many people, their careers as vets begin the day they stick their hands inside an animal's butt for the first time. Do you remember the first time you did that?
Oh, yeah. And you know what? It came out green because we didn't wear gloves in those days.
Oh, oh boy.
Oh, boy, yes. Sure enough, I sure scrubbed my arm an awful lot, but it doesn't come off very well the first time. Thank goodness we have gloves now, and yes, you learn how to use those, but sometimes they still break. That's the problem.
I read in your book that you actually challenged your crew, your National Geographic crew that follows you around. Hey, who wants to go?
Yes, you'd be surprised how many people are interested in doing it because they have no idea what it feels inside a cow. And it's always nice and warm in there, of course, because the body temperature is a little bit higher than ours. You have to learn to feel for things. And this is what we were taught in school. And I was in vet school. They said, if you're right-handed, you palpate left-handed. Your left hand can be made, is not, but can be made more sensitive than your right. And they're right. So all my palpations are done left-handed, so I can work with my right hand. And yes, people say, well, how can you feel all those things? Well, I tell them, you close your eyes and you see with your fingers. That's how you do it.
And I also think that if you're going to be a successful veterinarian, as we can tell from your book, you have to get the ick factor just out of your mind and just deal with this stuff.
Exactly right. When we were in the Netherlands, we were taught, hey, your clothes get dirty and they stain. Your skin can be scrubbed clean. And take your shirt off and get in there. When we have to do calvings, I still remember one big veterinarian, one big student that was there, just a big husky guy. They told us, you get both arms inside that cow if you have to reposition the calf. And he was says, I'm too big. I can't get two arms in there. Suddenly, the professor just halted and kicked his butt and says, get two arms in there, and he did. But yes, you learn to work with both arms in the cow. This is all part of, you know, birthing an animal where you need two arms in order to reposition these animals so they can come out.
Dr. Pohl, you went out on your own and you opened your own practice in the early 80s, right in the middle of Michigan. And talk to us a little about what you find so special about being a country vet in the middle of Michigan.
Well, because I was raised and grew up on a dairy farm, large animals always were my main hobby, concern, work. And I would always like to help the farmer make a better living. That's what we were taught to do. In those days, Isabella County, Michigan, had a lot of cows, a lot of steers, a lot of horses, and a lot of pigs, and not many veterinarians. And that's how we found it.
Perfect place for you. It's something you knew, and it was the kind of medicine you wanted to practice.
Yeah.
But you've seen some very, very big changes in farming in Michigan in these decades, haven't you?
Oh, yes, very much. When we started here, there were so many family farms. There were two or three farms every mile. And those have disappeared. Many children do not want the heavy work of 24/7. So the farms either got sold, rented out, or they changed over to crop farming.
What are we losing by losing these small family farms, do you think?
Well, we still have, you know, a big farming community, except the farms get bigger, which for me doesn't always mean that the cows get better care, but it is our economy that asks for, you know, cheaper food. Bigger farms make cheaper food. They have contracts with everything. You know, the big chain stores, they have basically their own pork industry because they want a steady supply available of pork and do not want to depend on the open market with the fluctuating prices. So basically, the whole concern from birth to finish of the pig industry under control.
It's nothing like the old McDonald farm that is kind of tucked away in our thoughts or our images
no,
of farming.
No, there are still quite a few left, and it all depends on the area. In the western part of Michigan, it seems like there's still more dairy farms than in the middle by us. But no, they are disappearing, and I'm sorry to see that go because it was such a big part of the American community.
Your National Geographic Wild series, The Incredible Dr. Pole, actually happened because of your son, Charles, whom we see on the program?
Yep. Yeah, that's correct. Charles, ever since he was like 3 years old, was infatuated with movies, and he wanted to become a movie producer. And he went to the film school in Miami, went to L.A., and after 8 years, had no chance of becoming a producer. So then he comes back to us and says, Dad, Mom, can we make a reality show about you? I says, who wants to watch me? You know, I'm an old guy. I'm doing dirty work. I do it my way. And he says, oh, you'd be surprised. We all were very much surprised.
And here you are going into your fifth season, and you're seen in 26 countries, and you write in your book you've actually seen yourself speaking Mandarin.
Yes, that was the strangest thing. You know, they had a clip on the cell phone of the show that started somewhere in China, and I couldn't understand a word I was saying.
What do you think explains the success of your show, Dr. Pole?
I think it's the honesty. You know, we are a family. We are a loving family. And that the show is real. You know, like I've said many times, I'm not putting that calf back in the cow to pull it out for a second take. You know, they have to get it done the first time. And it brings the family farm back into the American living room. So many Americans do not know what's going on at the farm. This show brings it back to them. And especially the children, the young kids, they love it. I'm very big in 4-H, and you know, the 4-H is still very high in Michigan. The kids that grow up with animals, where they have the responsibility to take care of animals, make sure that the animals get done before they can watch TV, I think make better people later on. That's my own private thing, but believe it sincerely.
Dr. Pole, anyone who is on any national television show is getting attention, be it good or not so good. And you have drawn some criticism from other vets who claim your approach to veterinary medicine is outdated or unsophisticated. And I'm wondering how you deal with those criticisms.
That's the problem. They are getting between 120, 180 hours of taping a week. They only use 40 minutes. So they don't show everything. You know, my clinic is modern, but I still treat animals as animals. Many veterinarians will do everything, imitate a doctor for all I care, you know, do things that for me are not necessary because we are treating animals. Animals are a lot tougher than humans. This is the way I handle them, down to earth, get it done, and do the best you can for the price that the people can afford. And in mid-Michigan, you know, the economy is not the greatest. And I still believe that everybody should have a pet because it is good for people to have animals around.
Now, your practice, as you write in your book, is the farming situation has changed. You've got a mixed animal practice now, so you might treat somebody's yes. parakeet or you might, you know, birth a calf. So you've treated pretty much every kind of animal. Is there any animal that you either fear or you're just plain creeped out by?
Not many, because, you know, if the people can have an animal like that in their house and it's sick, bring it in and I will help to see if I can help them. And through the show, you know, it's amazingly how many people now have pet chickens. Because in the show, one of the first shows, I set the leg on a very fancy pheasant. And the people saw that. So, hey, now we have a veterinarian that also knows a little bit about birds. So here they come.
Oh, you even treated a snake that had half of its back eaten off by a rat.
That happened many years ago, and I tell you, that was one of the strangest things we've seen, yes.
Mm-mm-mm. The TV show is very unflinching, and we do get a sense of animal medicine for sure. I'm thinking of the poor dog that got kicked in the head by the horse and lost his eye, and you take us right there. We see it all.
Yes.
What are you hoping readers get out of your book?
The readers will get out of a book that, you know, how it all started, you know, and my philosophy about helping animals.
Well, the book is Never Turn Your Back on an Angus Cow, My Life as a Country Vet, Dr. Jan Pohl. And the fifth season of The Incredible Dr. Pohl begins Saturday on National Geographic Wild. Good to talk with you, Dr. Pohl. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Same here.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It looks like Michigan's new anti-scrapping law isn't doing what it was supposed to. This new law was supposed to make it tougher to sell stolen scrap metal. It put limits on cash payments and created paper trails. The idea is that it would be easier for police to track down illegal scrappers. Democratic State Representative Rashida Tlaib represents Southwest Detroit. She has pushed for years to toughen Michigan's scrap metal laws. Representative Tlaib, is this new law doing what it's supposed to do?
Not completely, and it's primarily because of the number of loopholes that was left in that many police and prosecutors expressed concern over, and that's the loophole around the no cash exchange.
Who's taking advantage of them and how?
Well, right now, the current law allows commercial accounts. So if you're a mechanic, if you're a company that does air condition repairs, you're considered a commercial customer. And if you are a commercial account or a commercial customer, you do not have to go comply with this no cash exchange for $25 or more. So if you come in, a person that maybe cleaned out their garage, or maybe you are a scrap metal thief, and you come in with a stolen air conditioning unit or a catalytic converter, you bring that into a feeder yard. The scrap yard owner and employees have now been directed to make you a commercial account. Here, sign this, and we're now going to have a business relationship, and you're now going to be a commercial customer. Thus, you can now get direct cash exchange versus a check or a little EBT card at the end of the transaction.
So it sounds like some scrap metal dealers are playing along with this.
Absolutely. And they're actually telling on each other. I was only notified because one was telling on the other and didn't feel like it was fair that he was complying and someone else was using a number of the loopholes. You know, what's interesting enough is even the $25, which I think it should have never been a threshold at all, it should be no cash exchanges. We've learned from other states, other cities saw a 70% reduction when you got rid of cash exchanges, completely eliminated any cash exchanges at scrapyard facilities, and you saw the reduction. It's the instant cash exchanges. They would lose a huge number of their customers if they were having to be able to trace those transactions.
And I remember when this bill was signed into law last spring, you expressed worry about some of the scrappers bouncing from one yard to the next with $24.99 or lower. Are we seeing that?
Right now, I don't hear that from them. What I hear is that they're not even worried about it because they're making them commercial customers. So they're not even asking them to pop from one to the other. They're saying, hey, sign this, and we got a little document that says you are now a commercial customer. You know, the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police expressed the concern over loopholes. They said, we're on the ground with our officers. We hear daily of what is going on, and it's the no cash exchange with what they were hoping was going to get passed and signed by Governor Snyder. Instead, you had scrapyard industry influencing the legislature and telling them, look, if you just do this or that, we're going to be able to comply. Behind the scenes, what you were hearing is people were saying, well, you know these are loopholes. Prosecutor said, you know, they can get around this. And the fact of the matter is it passed overwhelmingly in the House with support of a no cash exchange, complete, no, very clean, no cash exchange. Instead, we stuck these little provisions in there that I knew many of the bad actors among the scrap metal industry was going to take advantage of. And that's what we have today.
Representative, your term limited. Do you want to or plan to introduce new legislation with the no cash exchange for these final 4 months you have in office?
Absolutely. And I'm already working with a city council person. You know, I'm not going anywhere. I'm still a resident of the city of Detroit. I live here. I see what happens to our communities, our neighborhoods on a daily basis. Don't think I'm not going to pick up and ask my current, you know, the state representative that replaces me to take on this issue. I think all of us need to be engaging our elected officials, especially because so many of them are new and don't understand completely what the current law did, which is it went halfway. It should have went fully forceful of no cash exchanges. Instead, you have these loopholes that I think need to be closed up as soon as possible.
Rashida Tlaib represents Detroit's 6th District in the State House. Representative, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
One of my earliest and happiest memories was going to Northland Mall in Southfield with my mom. We'd shop at Hudson's or maybe get a corned beef sandwich at Brothers for a treat. And I would always have to be lifted up to sit atop Marshall Frederick's The Boy and the Bear sculpture tucked in there right behind the boy. Northland was our mall, including the day that I found my wedding dress there at Hudson's. Well, cut to some 40 years later, as NPR business reporter Sonari Glinton is looking into the history of malls for a series with Youth Radio. Sonari, why did you use Northland as Exhibit A of the rise and fall of the American mall?
Well, it's one of the first malls, and it's also emblematic of sort of the problems and the promises of malls right now. So if you look at it, it looks a little long in the tooth. It's not, you know, all up and operating. That's sort of the sign of what's happening in malls right now.
Yeah, and we see it from coast to coast. And when I remember this, going back to what we know are the glory days of Northland, the 50s and the 60s, I don't think the term mall was not even used. It was Northland Shopping Center. We went to the shopping center, and then they enclosed it in 74 as we all began to embrace the idea of the mall. But you were pointing out to us in your piece for NPR that it's really Detroit and car culture and the history of malls that are all wrapped up.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, as a gentleman from the Henry Ford Museum said in my story, the car builds Detroit. Detroit builds the mall, and the mall and the car, you know, lead to the problems of Detroit. 1954, when this mall was opened, was the peak of receipts in downtown Detroit. It's as if they built this mall and said, okay, we're moving to the suburbs. And then everyone got up and went there. They're like, oh, we don't have to go all the way downtown. Let's go out nearer to home, and we have all the things we need, and we don't have to look for parking. And it's so innovative. I mean, when you think about Northland Mall, when you walk around there, it looks like every mall should look. But you think about 1954 and having a well-lit parking space. That was revolutionary. Like, I can just drive up and there will be a parking space.
That I don't now pay don't for?
Yeah, that I don't pay for. And nowadays, like, we assume that there's going to be parking. Like, there better be parking, right? You don't need the big you don't need the big lot to remind you that they have an extra space for you. I mean, all these little things were so innovative there. But what's interesting to me is that it's like the Stormcrow. It's like a harbinger of doom for downtown Detroit. As soon as that mall opens, it is the days of downtown Detroit are numbered.
And you had the sister malls. You had Eastland, Westland, and Southland. So they basically covered the Metro Detroit area to say, hey, come on here. And we certainly have spent a lot of time on this show talking about the effect of the 1967 riots and Detroit's troubles. So at the same time as people are leaving Detroit, here are the malls and more of them, you know, more of them operated. And I'm sure that this story has been repeated from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if Farmer Wilson had a farm and you had a Macy's and a Sears and Roebuck's, you could build the mall and you can get people to come to you. Right now, the country is over-retailed. We just have too much retail space.
Yeah.
And places like Sears and JCPenney's are not doing as well. That doesn't mean that the mall is dying necessarily. It's going through a transition, and we're going to see the difference in the years to come. I mean, I live here in Los Angeles, and you can already see what we have in store for the future.
Well, in fact, I saw some figures. One jumped out at me that a decade ago, we had more than 1,100 enclosed shopping malls in this country. And today, about 400 of those have been repurposed or closed down. And boy, that website, deadmalls.com, is pretty sad, packed with all these photos and remembrances of defunct malls. What factors do you see playing into the decline of the American mall?
One of the things is we've come to realize that when we got rid of that downtown, we kind of liked it, you know? Like,
yeah.
It was sort of cool to go to one place and, like, walk around in streets in the natural environment, whether it's cold or warm. But then there's the internet. So every year, a percentage of the receipts get shaved off. If you're a mall owner, you see, like, your tenants just not doing as well a little bit every year. People are distracted. Kids don't necessarily need to go to the mall to meet their friends and have fun. They can just do it in their bedroom. You know, there's all this stuff that didn't exist before. And the internet is really sort of focuses the attention on shopping because it's such an easy thing to get rid of.
Sonari, I saw the Department of Commerce reported that e-commerce sales for the second quarter of 2014 accounted for 6.4% of total sales. So yeah, that's there, but I have to think there are bigger and other things happening as well.
I mean, 6%, that seems small, but when you take out things that are normally in the retail numbers, that number seems artificially small.
Mm.
So when you look at back-to-school shopping, right, if I need to get, you know, my Trapper Keepers and all that stuff,
right.
Do I really need to go to the mall to get that? Would I? I might probably do that online. But what people are looking for now at malls, and this is what those 400 stores that you talked about, 400 malls being repurposed, is things like lifestyle centers and power centers. And a lifestyle center might have more restaurants than it has little stores. It might have, you know, two main acts during the day. It might have a train that runs through it where you can take your kids. It might have a park where you can go and have a picnic. I mean, as long as you get there, right, and
right.
you are spending some kind of money, that's what they want. Now, will we have all the malls, all the two anchor malls that we know of? Some of those malls are going to go away. If you're the third mall in Dexter, you're probably, you know, in trouble. There's not a third mall in Dexter, but you know what I mean. If you have a mall and you're in a small town and you don't have, you know, all that traffic, you're probably in some big trouble. And if you aren't able to sort of repurpose how you're doing business.
And I have to think that we really do have a different retail landscape, apart from the fact that we can go on, you know, at work and click, 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 and you've bought something. I also think that, you know, in 1960-something, when we would go shopping for school clothes or whatever, there wasn't a store like a Target or a Walmart. Because I can tell you, that's where we would see ourselves going for all those school supplies, because you could run to one corner and, you know, get the folders of the Trapper Keepers and then go a few steps away and, you know, buy the clothes and then pick up groceries. So that, I think, made a dent. But I also think we've seen, for example, anchor stores like Mervyn's fell into bankruptcy, and then you got other names gobbled up by bigger fish. Like here in Southeast Michigan, we saw Marshall Field's gobble up Hudson's, and then Macy's came right along and gobbled up Marshall Field. So is the fact that there are fewer anchor stores around, is that hurting malls? You can't hang them all on fewer anchor stores.
Well, I think that it's actually a little more different. I think that we are growing up a little bit, right? When we look at the numbers, we see that the high-end malls and the lower-end malls are where things are okay. It's in that middle. And I think part of what's happening in that case, like I would drive from Ann Arbor to the Somerset Collection. I'm not a Somerset Collection kind of guy, right?
Right.
But I would like to walk around and maybe stop off and have lunch. And maybe I might pick up a coat or some shoes. That is a thing that is happening around the country. So when we look at the malls that are struggling, the Somerset Collections, those places,
It's cranking.
They're doing fine.
They are.
They're A-okay.
Find a parking spot on any given Sunday at Somerset Mall.
Yeah.
Good luck.
It's your Briarwood. It's your mid-tier mall where the average person, you know, goes to shop. Because the average person is like, well, maybe I'll go out to the fancy mall and see how the other half lives and then, you know, get some food or something like that. I mean, that's what's going on. It's really in that center because so much of that work you could do for back-to-school shopping, right, that's not fun. You can just go through a list and click, but walking into Tiffany's, that's fun, right? You know, having a latte, that's fun. So all the sort of the boring, mundane parts of the mall are sort of going away. And the fun, let's see a band at the mall. I mean, think about that. I mean, like, that's a funny thing that, you know, people will go to see entertainment and go to classes and, you know, city halls are moving into malls. I mean, there's because at the same time where we're over retailed, you can't just like abandon a lot of this space. And there has to be a use for it.
And that's what I'm wondering, too, for the ones that have had to be repurposed or they've been abandoned. What's being done with these empty buildings? That's a lot of real estate.
One of the stories we did in our series was about a really innovative concept in Stockton, California, where some mall owners, well, the mall owners and kids sort of came up with a punk mall. Now, the problem in a lot of the country is that, you know, you can't sort of turn your mall into an art project, right? So what a lot of times are happening in these repurposings is, you know, your doctor's office will go into the mall. It brings traffic. It's good for, you know, patients because they can go for a walk. They don't have to sit in a doctor's office. You know, we're rethinking these sort of suburban town squares. It's really, they're turning back into that, and they're really sort of looking for how they can use their space wisely. When you look at the companies that own these malls, they are rejiggering their portfolio so they can get the top-end malls in one category and the mid-tier malls in another category so they can spend those off. They really want to have those high-end malls because that's where the receipts are really, really high. I should also say that mall traffic is down, but receipts are up. So that's an interesting little thing because I know what things cost. I don't need to go on a fishing expedition, right, to go to the shopping mall. I know how much a Trapper Keeper is. But when I'm going to buy something, I'm armed with information. And I think that's the average consumer has an infinite amount more information. So they may spend less time, but we're spending a little more money. I'm going to buy the knickknacks online, but I'm going to wait to get my giant TV at, you know, at the mall.
That's fascinating stuff. And your point about we kind of realized we missed the walkable downtowns, we certainly see a push to create that. And I'm even thinking of a couple of shopping centers in the Metro Detroit area that recreate what the old Northland felt like before it was enclosed. Partridge Creek is open air, walking hither and yon. Village of Meadowbrook in Rochester Hills is open air, because I remember when that opened, I thought, yep, we have circled back to what Northland felt like before they decided to seal it up and enclose it. So getting outdoors and dealing with rain and snow is part of it.
Yeah, that's what's funny is that, like, that's why it's so innovative, right? If it existed the way it did in 1954, it might be more successful than it is now. The idea of getting out and wandering around and getting, you know, the music and the stuff that goes into the mall. I should also say that Northland, you know, at that mall, there was a lot of entertainment going on. I mean, this is not a new thing. It wasn't just Santa. It was Broadway performances sometimes. There was a lot being done, especially in the 70s, to get people in that mall as Detroit was sort of changing. And it was still really important to the Hudson's Corporation to get people there. So there was a lot of extravaganzas that happened at that mall, wedding shows and things like that. That's what the mall owner falls back on. If I can't get the people in because the Sears is doing gangbusters, maybe I can put on a show.
And as you say, everything old is new again, because that's exactly what you see at the likes of the Somerset Mall. You could come in and see a show, or there could be a collection of movie costumes, whatever. But there's always a little something extra there. Talking malls and talking our shopping habits with NPR business reporter Sonari Glinton. Always great talking with you, Sonari. Thank you.
It's good to be with you, as always.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, and Michelle Hahn. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.